History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The trench was a horrible sight. Dead were stretched out on one side, one on top of each other, 6 feet high. I thought at the time I should never get the peculiar, disgusting smell of the vapor of warm human blood heated by the sun out of my nostrils. I would rather have smelt gas 100 times. I can never describe the faint, sickening, horrible smell, which several times nearly knocked me up altogether. That's my British captain, who was in the trenches throughout World War I. This episode, we're going to be getting deep into the trenches because this is important to understand the experience of the war. Why were there so many people who suffered terrible diseases? Why were there so many people who crumbled psychologically? Why was it so dangerous to charge no man's land? That's what we're going to be getting into with the trenches. So kick us off, James. What should we know about the trenches?
Well, it's important that we understand, for starters, that trenches were not invented during World War I. There, you had had the concept of fortifications is as old as warfare itself. People have known for a long, long time that you're a lot less likely to get hit by something, whether it's a bullet or an arrow or, who knows, a flying javelin. You're less likely to be hit if you are behind something than if you are out in the open. And we saw people build fortifications during the Revolutionary War, certainly the other wars in the 18th, 19th century, the Civil War. By the end of the Civil War, you had kind of like proto trenches. You had fairly extensive networks of trenches, but nothing like World War I. World War I is going to take the concept of a trench to a whole new level. So much so that the world of the trenches quickly took on a reality as a world apart. Trench warfare made a permanent imprint on the Western imagination. Phrases, it even, you know, the warfare in the trenches gave us a lot of phrases that we still use today. Things like over the top or in the trenches and no man's land. These things became a permanent part of the vocabularies of the languages of the various powers. So I want to start by talking about the structure of trenches. Trenches started as simple ditches, but they quickly became increasingly elaborate. You would have not just one long trench, but you would have rows and rows and rows of trenches that were connected by other trenches at a 90-degree angle or sometimes different angles. Barbed wire barriers were built in front of each side's trenches. Barbed wire is a huge part of the war. Trenches began to be built in zigzag formations to protect against artillery barrages. Boards had to be put at the bottom of the trenches due to moisture. We talked earlier in the last episode about how these trenches would fill up with water or with snow or with mud or some combination of all those. They had to, and that caused trench foot. So they started putting boards. They were typically about 10 feet high, the trenches were, and they were lined, I should say 10 feet deep, actually, because they went down into the ground. They were lined with sandbags. They were propped up with pieces of wood, sometimes metal. They had a parapet in the front, and they also had what was called a fire step, and this allowed people to see over the edge. This is what you would stand on before you went over the top. They also had machine gun and mortar batteries placed at intervals. So again, very elaborate, don't think of just one big long deep ditch, but think of an entire underground network. They had tunnels, they had rooms for sleeping, they had command posts, they had places to store ammunition and food and all kinds of supplies. So it's just incredibly elaborate, right, Scott?
Yeah, we can barely do justice to this. We'll mention a few movies later on in this episode that I think can give you a sense of what it would be like to be in the trenches. And it's not just one line, obviously. It's multiple lines back from the front before you enter no man's land. So tell us about the various levels in the trenches.
Sure. First of all, let me say that the area in between the two sides was called no man's land. That's another phrase that is still fairly common in the English language. No man's land could be anywhere from just 30 yards to several hundred yards wide. You know, it was usually 200 or 300 yards. You didn't usually get super close to your enemy. You wanted some space there, right? But no man's land was in some ways like the surface of the moon after battles had been fought. It was filled with shell holes. It was filled with the remains of fortifications. We talked about barbed wire, and it would often be filled with dead bodies, both human and animals. There are many, many horses were used in World War I. So, and a lot of times people weren't able to go out and bury these bodies, because if you tried to go out and grab a dead body or even a wounded person sometimes and bring them in, you would be shot yourself. So the bodies tended to pile up, and that's part of the horror of the trenches. I mentioned that they were done in zigzags, but Scott, you wanted to elaborate on that?
Yeah, so I think we'll probably try to include maps. There are examples of trench lines. James will mention the different lines in a second here, front lines and then on back. But don't imagine a bunch of horizontal lines with clean vertical lines connecting them back and forth. The zigzag is going off in all different directions. That's because you don't want to get straight firing along the trench if an enemy does manage to get through. So you have alternating straight and angled lines, and the traverse is the name given to the angled parts of the trench. So just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't want, if somebody fired a shell and it landed and came sideways, you didn't want it to just bowl over every single person, every single thing that was in the trench. So that's why they zigzagged them. Like Scott said, just wanted to elaborate on that. The trenches consisted of several lines. You would have the front lines. You would have behind them support lines, reserve lines, retreat lines. There were also supply lines, saps, they were sometimes called. Those were lines that ran at an angle to the front line and the other lines, so that you could communicate between the different lines. Again, a picture will be very helpful. We'll post, get one up on the website. But there were workshops, training facilities, headquarters, all kinds of things within these trench networks. You didn't really have barracks. A lot of times you had just dugouts, and people had to kind of curl up to sleep or just kind of crash out even within the main trench. So sleeping was hard to do anyway because of what was going on, but you didn't have exactly, it wasn't like the hotel, a nice hotel, the Hilton or something, right? Or Waldorf Astoria. In the dugout, sometimes you could fit up to three men that where they would squeeze in for shelter, especially if you were being shelled. You wanted to not just be in the trench, but with something over your head as well. Trench networks were so complicated later on in the war that they had to be maps. They had to have guides. You had to give people directions. You see this in the movie 1917. Somebody says, well, where's so-and-so? I'll go down here, turn left, and so on and so on.
They have street names and everything for it.
Yeah, they would name them after places in the home country. Behind the trenches were sometimes bunkers that were reinforced with concrete. Behind the bunkers were artillery positions. The Germans were especially good at building these bunkers as they became increasingly defensive as the war progressed. Some trenches even had railways in them, and these could be used to quickly bring in reinforcements.
Sounds like the Germans to me.
Yeah, that sounds like a German thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to mention 1917 again, maybe that alone will be our drink for this series, but it's just a great movie for a visual understanding of the war. And a thing that does well is show the difference between German trenches and other players in the war. They're depicted as higher quality than the British trenches. They have concrete bunkers. They have underground barracks that are vast. And the German trenches are considered the best engineered in the world at the time. Part of the reason, beyond their engineering prowess, they were also the first to build trenches on the Western Front. So they had more time to improve their trenches. And from 1914 to 1916, you'll see that they're usually on the defensive side of the battle. So it was strategic to have better trenches. For the British, though, they're used more as a jumping off point for attack. So sounds more pleasant to be in a German trench than a British trench.
Yeah, and the Germans, I don't want to spoil the movie for anybody in case you haven't seen it. But let me just say this in general. The Germans sometimes would booby trap their trenches when they evacuated and moved back further back. as we're going to see they're going to do during the war. Now, what was life like in the trenches? The soldiers would stay in these trenches for months at a time sometimes. So it wasn't just the place where you fought. It was your home, at least temporarily. It was where you lived. Soldiers were constantly exposed to the weather. Of course, the trenches didn't have a roof over them. So if it rained, you got rained on, unless you could find a covered spot somewhere inside of the trench. If it snowed, you got snowed on, and so on. Snow and mud or water, as I mentioned before, were commonly present. I talked about how they put boards down sometimes to combat people's feet getting sopping wet. What's another thing they did, Scott?
Well, they would have a narrow drainage channel they would dig out. It was called the sump. So if you are in a place like the Midwest, you have a sub pump in your basement to get water out. So this would then be covered with wooden trench boards, but it did not work at all. And if you hear an account, you hear lice is a big one, mud is another. And a trench newspaper, they had those, it was produced by British troops called the Wipers Times, said, "Hell is not fire. That would be the ultimate in suffering. Hell is mud." So everywhere, can't escape it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Fire, you know, burns you up and you're gone pretty quickly, but mud, you just suffer and suffer and suffer. You know, one thing I'm not sure if I've got this in the notes looking, I did look at them a little while ago, but I will say that, we'll talk about it in a minute. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about trench foot. Let me just push pause on that. Soldiers in these trenches, they took on a near primitive existence. Filth was everywhere. The smell was just, I just can't imagine it, Scott. The smell was horrible, unbearable. You read about the smells of rotting bodies of men and animals, overflowing latrines, the inabilities of the soldiers to bathe, just almost every foul smell you can think of, they had it. And they also had vermin. They had rats. Rats were everywhere, and they got huge because, again, this is gross. I hope nobody's eating as they listen to this. Maybe finish up real quick and then come back. But the rats would actually feed on the dead bodies of men and animals, and that would make them very fat. Scott has a quote about the rats.
Right. And again, this is unpleasant, but I don't know how to do justice to this without it. This is from Captain Robert Graves in his autobiography. And he said, "Rats came up from the canal, fed on the plentiful corpses, and multiplied exceedingly. While I stayed here with the Welch, a new officer joined the company, and in token of welcome was given a dugout containing a spring bed. When he turned in that night, he heard a scuffling, shone his torch on the bed, and found two rats on his blanket tussling for the possession of a severed hand." So, disease everywhere, absolutely disgusting. Can't imagine a filthier war.
Yeah.
But when they weren't filthy, they were bored. So, what was that like, James?
Yeah, they just, it was extreme boredom for a lot of the time, punctuated by moments of extreme horror. They would do things like read, they would play cards, they would gamble, they would do other time-killing activities to beat the boredom, write letters, read letters, you know, things like that. Just whatever they could do to try to find something to do when they weren't working. And the thing about the trenches, you were never really safe. We've talked a lot about artillery shells. The thing about artillery shells is you hear them coming. You get some kind of warning, so you can usually have a little bit of time to take cover, to get down, get, you know, or get into a dugout or something. But one of the things that you never could quite prepare for were trench raids and enemy snipers. Snipers are it's pretty clear what those are. Both sides, all sides would have snipers constantly on duty. And anytime they would see a head pop up or even a hand pop up, they would fire. Trench raids are when one side would just get a bunch of guys and they would just charge across no man's land, cut through the barbed wire, or just go through openings if there were already some openings, and just surprise and just jump in. You see this in the movie All Quiet on the Western Front, the book as well, of course. So, and those didn't announce themselves, right, Scott? They didn't say, "Okay, we're coming. You ready?" They weren't quite like the artillery. And the Germans especially had a group of people called stormtroopers. And these were guys that were gung-ho. They loved to fight. They loved to kill. They were kind of, I don't know what you would compare them to nowadays, but they were pretty sadistic. They wanted to go in there and, you know, just raise a lot of Cain and and kill as many people as they could, and then retreat back across no man's land to their own trench lines. And I'm also going to read a quote from Robert Graves. I've been reading through this, and we talked earlier about soldiers who would purposely injure themselves. A lot of soldiers wanted to get a wound that was light enough to where they would survive and not have serious consequences, but enough to where they would get sent to a hospital and maybe even get sent home. And some of them called them a cushy, meaning a cushy wound. And here's what Graves writes. Graves was an officer in the British side who later went on to be a famous author in his own right. And he wrote one of the most famous World War I books called Goodbye to All That. Scott just quoted from it. Here's another quote. He says, May 24th, tomorrow we return to the trenches. The men are pessimistic but cheerful. They all talk about getting a cushy one to send them back to Blighty. Blighty is, it seems, Hindustani for home. My servant Fry, who works in a paper bag factory at Cardiff in civil life, has been telling me stories about cushy ones. Here are two of them. A bloke in the Munsters once wanted a cushy, so he waves his hand above the parapet to catch Fritz's attention. Fritz is one of the slang for the German soldiers. Nothing doing. He waves his arms about for a couple of minutes. Nothing doing. Not a shot. He puts his elbows on the fire step, hoists his body upside down, and waves his legs about till he gets blood to the head. Not a shot did old Fritz fire. Oh, says the Munster man, I don't believe there's a damned square head there. Where'd the German army go? He has to peek over the top. Crack, he gets it in the head. Fine. So again, you just never know. You might stick your hand up, you might, whatever you do, you might not take a bullet, but if you stick your head up, you're probably going to get shot. Another story, bloke in the Camerons wanted a cushy bad. Fed up and far from home, he was. He puts his hand over the top and gets his trigger finger taken off, and two more beside. That done the trick. He comes laughing through our lines by, hey, I got shot in the hand. No, I'm not. That's not from the book, but that's me interpreting it. He comes laughing through our lines. See, lads, he says, I'm off to Bunny Scotland. Is it beauty? But on the way down the trench to the dressing station, he forgets to stoop low where the old sniper's working. He gets it through the head too. Fine, we laugh. Fit to die. Now that sounds awful, right? Laughing at the situations, but there was a lot of dark humor. That's one way people would cope with the hell that they were living in at the time.
That's something that to go back to a movie, They Shall Not Grow Old. In retrospect, someone says, we were always laughing at each other because our reality was so grim that we had to joke whenever we could, whenever there was something right to laugh at, even if it's someone getting killed.
Right.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Heroism seemed pointless. War seemed to be all about technology and not individuals. Soldiers felt dehumanized. They felt they were just meat being thrown into the grinder, and in some ways they were. Now, soldiers didn't spend all their time in the trenches. They were rotated. They would spend usually like 1 week on the front lines, then a week in the reserve trenches, then time behind the lines. Sometimes they got leave. But what was their daily routine like? What would a typical day look like? Here's what it would look like. They would start early in the morning with stand to, and that was everybody getting ready, prepared for an attack at the beginning of the day. Then there would be what they called, I love this phrase, Scott, the daily hate, a big artillery or machine gun barrage. Then, if no attack happened, in other words, if there was no trench raid coming from the other side or a major raid or major attack, there would be meals, sentry duty, repairing and adding on to trenches, cleaning weapons, inspections, and other duties. And at the end of the day, they would stand to again. So again, most days were like this, just very monotonous routine. But when it wasn't monotonous, it was hell. At night, soldiers had to be prepared for attacks. Lack of sleep was the norm. Sentry duty was assigned in 2-hour shifts. So even if you could sleep, you would be awakened and you'd have to be on guard duty for 2 hours and then back to sleep. That's no fun. Disease, as we've already talked about in a previous episode, was rampant, like trench foot and trench fever, which came from vermin and lice. The British Army alone, just the British, suffered about 20,000 casualties from trench foot by the end of 1914. So that's just a few months into the war. But trench foot decreased as the quality of the trenches increased. And I was thinking about this earlier and then I kind of tabled it, but now I'm going to discuss it. They got to where the soldiers would have a buddy. Everybody would have a partner and you would do foot inspections every day. You would take off your boots and your socks and your buddy would look at your feet and inspect for signs of trench foot. And then the guy would put his shoes and or boots and his socks back on. And then he would do the same to you. And that helped cut down on the amount of trench foot. So, you know, they learned from their experience, Scott. It's just like every war at the beginning, people are just making it up as they go and improvising, but they get better and better as the war progresses. There was also shell shock, as we talked about, PTSD. Soldiers gave names to sections of the trenches. They often evoked places back home. And as we kind of touched on already, they tried to make the best of things, often using dark humor. Here is a story that I got from the Great Courses lecture series on World War I, which is really, really good. And it's by Dr. Vyas Lulevichus, and he is a professor at the University of Tennessee. He talks about how at a British salient at Ypres, there was a spot where an arm was sticking out from a trench wall. So this poor guy, Scott, was dead, and some poor dead guy had gotten buried, and somehow at least part of his body was incorporated into the trench. So soldiers would go by when they went over the top and started heading off to attack. They would pass by this arm sticking out of their own trench wall. They called the arm Jack, and they would shake the hand on their way out of and back into the trenches.
Good luck. It's for good luck.
Yeah, exactly. You know, things like that happened. They also published trench newspapers. Scott quoted from the Wipers Gazette or whatever it was. I forgot the full name of it. They would put on plays. They would show movies. About a third of Allied casualties on the Western Front occurred in the trenches, not out in the open. So that's pretty amazing. You know, the purpose of these trenches was for protection, for defense, and they worked fairly well, but nevertheless, a third of Allied casualties occurred in the trenches. There were a lot of shelling of trenches. Dan Carlin, the great podcaster that we've referred to previously, he has a very interesting insight on this. And he argues that the 4 years of World War I may have been the most hellish of any war, at least in modern history. He said, you didn't want to be a soldier. If you had to pick a war to be a soldier in, World War I would have to be one of your last choices. And the reason for this is, unlike in World War II and other wars, in which the armies often moved, in World War I, they mostly stayed put, at least on the Western Front. You know, the other fronts are a little bit different. But on the Western Front, you didn't move around a lot. It was not a war of movement. And this meant that the soldiers had to fight where they also lived. Bodies had to be buried very close to where the soldiers stayed, and often shellings and the digging of more or deeper trenches caused these bodies to be unearthed. So that's how horrific is that, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like this. In the Middle Ages, you wouldn't be entrenched for long periods of time in the same way because your tactics wouldn't account for it. Even up into the early 19th century, the fire of muskets is not accurate over long ranges, so you can do charges, you can do other things. Warfare favors velocity. And then by World War II, you get over the hump of what World War I is in, and you have armor and other things that can allow you to keep moving. And even if you have heavy artillery fire, there are ways to get around it so you don't have to dig in. There are little things like the Battle of the Bulge where soldiers were dug in, but that's for days, a few weeks. That is not what is going on here in the trenches by any means. So, James, why don't you discuss the technology? What's going on? We're at this weird intersection in the Venn diagram of history where, for whatever reason, it tactically makes sense to stay put for a long period of time when it wouldn't make sense to do that before or after this period.
Right. One reason was the use of the machine gun. This is not the first war where automatic weapons were used, but it's the first one where they were used on a massive scale and by both sides. Machine guns had a range of more than 1,000 yards, and they fired up to 600 rounds per minute. So one machine gun crew could hold off masses of enemies. You know, you watch footage or you watch these movies where they've worked hard to accurately depict what happened, and you just see these huge long lines of troops advancing, and then the machine gun fires off and just men just are cut down. It's just like a knife going through the line, cutting down. It just takes out hundreds and thousands of men in one round. You also had non-recoil artillery. This was not jolted out of position by every firing. We talked about the big Krupps and the Škoda guns that were used by the Germans in the siege of Belgium in a previous episode, how they were concreted down so that they didn't move. But you also had these artillery that just, it just kind of came down into itself and then back out. Didn't have to be resighted. It didn't have to be recalibrated. And this allowed for precise attacks. And then you had poison gas. And I've got the date, I believe, here is wrong. I think that it was actually, it was used at the Battle of Bolimov, which was in January of 1915, but it was first used on the Western Front in April of 1915 by the Germans. Scott has a quote about poison gas.
Right. This is an account from the New York Tribune about that exact battle that James mentioned. And they say, "The gaseous vapor, which the Germans used against the French divisions last Thursday, contrary to the rules of the Hague Convention, introduces a new element into warfare. The attack of last Thursday evening was preceded by the rising of a cloud of vapor, greenish-gray and iridescent. That vapor settled to the ground like a swamp mist and drifted toward the French trenches on a brisk wind. Its effect on the French was a violent nausea and faintness, followed by an utter collapse. It is believed that the Germans, who charged in behind the vapor, met no resistance at all, the French at their front being virtually paralyzed." So when something is too heinous to be used in World War I as a weapon, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, no kidding. It was so awful and so horrible that even Adolf Hitler refused to use it in World War II. It's too bad for Hitler. That's that's saying something. Part of that is because Hitler himself was gassed. He was a soldier for the German army during World War I. As we're going to see, we're going to drop a lot of names along the way, aren't we, Scott? A lot of World War II leaders, some political, some military, were serving in World War I as younger men. I think that quote pretty much sums it up. There's just not that much to say. And we're going to see how, beyond that, we're going to see how the gas technology is going to evolve and the gases that are used by both sides, I should say, not just the Germans, both sides are going to use them. Even the Americans will. They're going to get uglier and nastier and more harmful as we progress through the war. But the first time people didn't know what the heck it was and they didn't quite understand. And even after people knew exactly what the gas was and what it did, trying to get people to use their gas mask was difficult at times because the early gas masks, they were very hot. They made you sweaty. The eye goggles would fog up and you couldn't see. It was hard to breathe inside of them. So people would feel like they were suffocating and then they would tear them off only to die from gas. So it was just an awful situation. So all these things that we've mentioned, these new technologies or relatively new technologies, the machine gun, non-recoil artillery, poison gas, trenches, these gave defense a great advantage. And the cult of the offensive was dead.
All right. Well, that explains a lot on why so many people are taken out. But there's another factor too about World War I that's interesting. And that's, it's one of the last times before you see combined arms as a cornerstone of warfare. Now, that does come out later on in the war when they're trying to break out of the logjam of trench warfare here. But before that, you have single arms where things happen sequentially. You don't have artillery complementing infantry who are complementing cavalry, which later on would be a group of tanks complementing what would later on be an airstrike. It happens more sequentially. So, James, can you walk us through what does a typical attack look like?
A typical attack would start with a massive artillery barrage. And the purpose of the barrage was twofold. One, it was hoped that the artillery would cut the barbed wire. This rarely ever worked very well. And it was also hoped that it would damage enemy defenses. You know, they would just, and these barrages are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're going to use thousands of shells per day, if not tens of thousands. But and they would damage the enemy defenses to some degree, but they never did the damage that the attackers thought they should do. And what they did do was they ruined the element of surprise. You know, if you want to, if you, you might as well just send a telegram saying, "Hey, we're coming. We're going to come hit you in just a second," because that's what the artillery barrage says. You, once the artillery barrage was over, the defenders knew that infantry would be coming across no man's land. And so that's their time to get their machine guns and their mortars ready to go. So after the artillery barrage, attacking units were ordered to go over the top. The commanders would blow a whistle. They would jump onto the fire step, go on ladders, and they'd go out of the trenches with bayonet charges through no man's land and into enemy trenches. They often found that the barbed wire was barely affected at all. They were being fired on by artillery. They would tear up no man's land, so there were constantly new craters, shell craters being made, and people would fall into them. Sometimes dead, sometimes alive. Soldiers often got caught on barbed wire, and then they would be blown to bits by either artillery or by machine gun fire or rifle fire if they got close enough. The attackers would be mowed down by machine guns operated by the defenders. And there's an interesting quote from the famous historian A.J.P. Taylor. He said, "Defense was mechanized, attack was not." So attack was still very much like what you would have seen in the days of Scott's favorite General Napoleon or, you know, the Civil War or whatever. The attack was just kind of bonsai charge. Let's go. Let's run across there. Don't stop and fire. Run across with your bayonet. Try to reach the trenches and get in and kill as many of the defenders as you can. But defense was just, you know, machines constantly. So it was almost suicidal to even try to attack.
It's almost like everybody read a book about Pickett's Charge, but they only read the beginning when everyone is drawing up their plans, and they didn't read the end when they saw what happened.
Yeah, let's recreate Pickett's Charge, but this time let's do it on a pockmarked battlefield where everybody's going to be falling and stumbling all the time, and let's do it where the defenders have way better weapons. They're going to blow us away even more, and so on. Yeah, that's just great. But the commanders, they refused to adapt to the new reality, and the commanders stubbornly clung to old notions of warfare, including cavalry, heroic bayonet charges, and the cult of the offensive. That really died hard. I don't want to say that they never changed their tactics, because they did, but very incrementally and very gradually. They're going to come up with new ideas that are going to, and by the end of the war, things will be pretty different from they were from the way they were at the beginning. Now, the soldiers in general, there are exceptions, but the average soldier on both sides didn't really have a personal grudge or a beef with the people on the other side. They didn't, you know, most English soldiers didn't hate Germans. Germans didn't necessarily hate English or French. Some did, but a lot didn't. And occasionally a system would prevail called the live and let live system. And in this system, it's system makes it sound really formal. It was informal, of course. But soldiers on both sides would sometimes make agreements to not attack at certain times, for example, at breakfast or at religious ceremonies or in certain places. They might also pretend to not see each other in no man's land, where soldiers might be repairing barbed wire. Commanders, though, of course, they didn't like this. They were not happy about this live and let live. They were infuriated. They forbade any kind of agreements, informal though they were. But the most famous example of the live and let idea is the famous Christmas Truce of 1914. We can't talk about World War I without talking about this, right, Scott?
Yes.
It's famous. I have a children's book based on this that I used to read to my kids.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
This began with the displaying of Christmas trees on both sides. Both sides began singing hymns and carols, and eventually meetings and games between the two sides occurred. You know, a few guys would step out, and a few guys from the British side would step out, and so on. Photographs were taken, signatures were exchanged. It was just like, you know, these guys weren't enemies. It was like these are old buddies just hanging out, having a great time, having a party. commanders, of course, were very angry when they found out about this. They tried to cover it up, and of course, they forbade it. There would never be another Christmas truce after 1914. But there's a movie, isn't there, Scott?
Yeah, it's called Joyeux Noël. Great movie. It's about this exact same thing, and it has German and Scottish and French soldiers. So it depicts this exact thing where soldiers are on both sides. It's around Christmas time. And what sets the stage for this is that Wilhelm, the German crown prince, he sends the lead singer of the Berlin Imperial Opera on a solo visit to the front lines, Walter Kirchhoff. And he is singing Christmas tunes. I forget which one. I think it might be Silent Night, but in German.
Yeah, I think so.
And it leads French soldiers in the trenches to stand up and applaud, and they start singing on their side. And then with the Christmas truce, there's a soccer game between the two sides. And I'll say one thing about this. This type of feeling that James described, where you might not have animosity to the man on the other side, even though he's shooting a gun at you and might have killed your best friend. In a strange sort of way, you feel a kinship in that you understand each other in a way that nobody else really would, because you've suffered through the trenches and the same experience. I've heard stories like this in other wars and other times, where somebody who is a World War II vet will late in life go to Germany or go to Japan, and through some research may actually find some enemy soldiers that would have been fighting on the other side. And you can have YouTube clips of these two talking with each other, these men in their 90s speaking through a translator, and they're laughing and they're joking about what they went through. I guess the best analogy is, let's just bring in another movie. Why not? This one is not a World War One movie, but it's one of the best action movies and dramas ever. James, do you know the Al Pacino, Robert De Niro movie Heat from the 90s?
I've not seen it. I've heard of it.
Classic movie, bank heist movie, where Al Pacino is, I think he's an FBI agent. Robert De Niro is a bank robber. And in the end, spoiler alert, everyone, for a plus 20-year-old movie, Robert De Niro is shot by Al Pacino, but the two sort of share a moment where they understand each other, that they're both parts of the same system, and they get each other. So that's what I think of when I think about soldiers on different sides of the lines understanding one another, even though they might be shooting. And C.S. Lewis, a famous British author who also fought in World War One, has a famous quote where, when he thinks about warfare, and he mentions it in regards to religious duties, that there's nothing necessarily irreligious about fighting in war, that he could imagine the two soldiers, once they arrive in heaven, laughing about their kerfuffle as they get there. So, interesting perspectives on all this.
Yeah, there's a famous scene in All Quiet on the Western Front where the main character, it's told from the point of view of the Germans. The main character is a German soldier named Paul, and it's during an attack, and he ends up in a shell crater, and then all of a sudden a French soldier jumps into the crater, and Paul pulls out his knife. He doesn't use his bayonet because he's not able to get his rifle going at the time, but he pulls out it's like a Bowie knife kind of, and he stabs the guy, and then the guy's dying, and then he starts feeling bad about it, and he starts talking to him and saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," and he tries to give him water, and he tries to actually save him, but it's too late. So yeah, all kinds of irony with the two sides. One other thing I have to mention, this is also commemorated in a music video that was made in the early 80s by Paul McCartney. It's called The Pipes of Peace. That was an interesting video where he tells the story of shows the story of the Christmas truce. All right, one last thing we're going to talk about are some superstitions, legends, and myths that grew up around the trench warfare of World War One. And this first one, I don't know if this is really a myth or not. This one sounds pretty accurate to me, but Dr. Lalouvicius mentions it as a myth. So the idea is never light three cigarettes from the same match. So think about this. If you, the first time you light a cigarette, then on the other side, they'll see you. They'll see the little fire, the spark. And then the second one, they'll aim, and the third one, they'll fire. So cigarettes were very widely smoked on both sides. So never light three cigarettes from the same match. This is actually referred to in All Quiet on the Western Front. Another legend was at the Battle of Mons. Many British, this is the one where the British soldiers held, the riflemen held off a superior German force for a long time before they had to retreat. Many British soldiers believed that angels had rescued them from the Germans. This is based on a short story. Some also claimed that arrows from ghostly bowmen had killed many Germans. The location wasn't far from where some of the battles of the Hundred Years' War had occurred. So no arrows were ever actually found in any German bodies, but it's a great story. At the Battle of the Somme, this is later on, we'll talk about this, in 1916, a statue of the Virgin Mary was seen, and it was leaning to one side. And it was believed that when the statue fell, the war would end. This sadly did not come true. The statue fell, but the war didn't end. There was also a myth, and I think this is another British propaganda thing, the crucified Canadian. There was somebody invented a story that the Germans had actually taken a Canadian soldier and crucified him. That turned out to not be true as well. And then finally, there was this idea, actually a couple more things. One was the No Man's Land Army, that there was out somewhere in No Man's Land hiding from both sides. It was made up of deserters and other soldiers acting independently.
They're just going to beat both sides, right?
Yeah, why would you do that?
Why not just desert the old-fashioned way and leave? Come on.
Yeah, how would you eat? Yeah, I mean, how would you not get blown to bits? And finally, this idea of the trench community. This kind of harkens back a little to what we were talking about earlier. This is the concept that soldiers in the trenches had been forged into a community, class, and other backgrounds were broken down. There is some truth to this, but there will continue to be class divisions very much alive in Britain after World War I. All right, so those are some myths and legends, and we'll talk about, I'll kind of sum up the movies in a minute, but do you want to add anything here, Scott?
Yeah, I think your last point, I want people to remember that, yes, there is an esprit de corps, a band of brothers, as there is in any war, but with the trench community, keep in mind this is still at the end of an age where class very much exists, and even to your fellow chums, you wouldn't call each other by your first name, or as they referred to it then, your Christian name. You would refer to each other, even very close friends, by your last name. First names were essentially for family members otherwise, and for officers, for those of a different background than you, you would call them sir. There is still a line of separation between you and them. It can be broken. There's always gray lines throughout history. I mean, things are never as hard and firm as we imagine, but this isn't the 21st century where you think of American GIs talking to each other and like American Sniper or something like that.
Band of Brothers or something like that.
Yeah. So we don't want to glamorize it too much, but well, James and I have, we've mentioned a lot of movies. What were some of them? And I guess this can be a homework assignment if people are supplemental reading, if they want to find more.
All right, everybody, you're required to watch these by the next episode or else. No, I'm just kidding. But we'll have a quiz, right, Scott? Of course, we talked about 1917. I imagine a lot of our listeners have already probably seen that movie. But if you haven't, you've got to see that. It's very good. It was really almost won Best Picture. I think it did get the Golden Globe for Best Picture, but it didn't get the Oscar. But 1917 is terrific. I've mentioned several times All Quiet on the Western Front. And I would watch both versions if you can, the 1931 and the 1979 one. They're both good in different ways. There's also a BBC series, and this is very brief. There's five episodes. They're about 30 minutes apiece, so you can go through it pretty quickly. It's basically the whole thing is the length of a long movie. It's called The Passing Bells, and you can watch that on Amazon Prime, at least as of June 2020. It tells the story of a German soldier and his experience in the war, as well as a British. And so all these movies will give you great insight into the uniforms, life in the trenches, the food they ate, what battle was like. There will be others that we'll discuss later. You may be saying, well, what about so-and-so? Well, we'll talk about that later because there are some movies that are about specific battles and we want to save those for the time. Oh, there's also the movie War Horse that came out. You remember that one, Scott?
Yeah, was that a Steven Spielberg movie?
It may have been. I went and saw it in the theater. I didn't think it was great. I mean, it was pretty good. I don't remember much about it other than Benedict Cumberbatch is in it. And then there's this horse that's constantly running around the battlefield. But it's a pretty good story, too. It talks a lot about no man's land. So there you go. There's our movie recommendations for now. We'll have more. We'll have some more. We'll have documentaries as well. And of course, once again, let's mention They Shall Not Grow Old, which is not a movie per se. It's a documentary, but it's very much, it's almost like a cross between the two. Wouldn't you say, Scott? It's
right. It's what they did is they found, testimony from World War One soldiers. This probably would have been in the 1960s, 1970s, at the earliest date they could have recorded it. And so they have this overlaid with, footage, but like we said earlier, they actually had lip readers go in and see what people are saying in the footage, then have voice actors recreate it. They add sound effects. I don't think I've ever had an experience like it where I think I am in a time machine and I have stepped back to see another world that no longer exists. They talk about all the things that we mentioned in this episode about rampant rats, rampant lice, the feeling of shell shock, being on edge, everything else. So to really get into the feeling of what that was like, that's a fantastic movie or documentary if you prefer.
Yeah, if you watch all these things we've listed, you will have a really good feel for what it was like to be a soldier, during common soldier. You know, we didn't even talk about officers, Scott. Their experience was a little bit different, although a lot of the junior officers were killed as well. But anyway, that's what we got for you this time.
All right, well, let me see. Tell me if I have our episode order right. Is Gallipoli next episode?
Yes, it is. That's our third key battle. We're going to go out to the east again. We're going to talk about the entry of the Ottoman Empire into the war and the consequences of that, including the Battle of Gallipoli. Scott's going to drive the bus on that one because he's obviously, as we've discussed, he's a scholar of the Ottoman Empire and he's read a lot about it in the past. That will be our next one. And then after that, we're going to talk about the war events of 1915. 1915, other than Gallipoli, is not going to have any of our key battles. The Western Front is going to have battles. It's going to have quite a few, but they would be relatively minor compared to some of the other ones we're going to talk about.
Right. And 1915, the Battle of Gallipoli, is also going to see the entrance for the Ottoman side of a young, dashing colonel who will later on become one of the main historical key figures of the early 20th century and shake the pillars of heaven. You can tell I lived in Turkey a long time. So if you can't guess who I'm saying, you'll find out then. But I'll leave it for a spoiler. But you're going to introduce a very incredible person who has an incredible influence on history. And I'll leave that there with a spoiler. Or not a spoiler, but a cliffhanger. So hope you enjoy this episode, and we'll see you then. All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic spy masters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.